Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that the 2016 election could be contested, following a question by NPR's Terry Gross, who asked Hillary Clinton, "Would you completely rule out questioning the legitimacy of this election if we learned that the Russian interference in the election was even deeper than we know?" To which Hillary Clinton replied, "No, I wouldn't rule it out." An expert on the history of presidential elections and election chicanery, the author of Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America, investigative journalist Andrew Gumbel, joins us. We'll discuss how at least two presidents, Samuel Tilden in 1876 and Al Gore in 2000, won the popular vote and the Electoral College but lost their elections, and look into the possibility of a do-over if the special counsel Robert Mueller were to find compelling evidence that the combination of Russian active measures, voter roll hacking, and campaign collusion was sufficient to swing the election, given the narrow 77,000 vote margin Trump won the Electoral College by. Then we'll assess the chances of the effort underway to repeal Obamacare with the Graham-Cassidy bill that is being pushed through the Senate ahead of a September 30 deadline. Michael Hitzig, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Los Angeles Times, joins us to discuss this wolf in sheep's clothing that is being cast as a moderate common sense alternative to the draconian repeal bills that have floundered so far, and his latest article at the Los Angeles Times, "The GOP's Last-Ditch Obamacare Repeal May Be the Worst One Ever." Yet, I should say. Then finally, we will speak with Aziz Huq, professor of law at the University of Chicago, who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, "How Would Trump Handle a Terror Attack?" and express his concern that, like Syria and North Korea, Trump will seize on fiery bluster and dramatic threats and treat a terrorist tragedy as a campaign event, as he has done with the recent hurricanes in Texas and Florida. And joining us now is Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Matters. And his latest book just out is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gumbel.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And as I mentioned on NPR's Terry Gross's program today, Hillary Clinton amped things up a little bit in response to a question, which I mentioned before. Would you completely rule out questioning the legitimacy of this election if we learned that the Russian interference in the election was even deeper than we know? To which Hillary Clinton said, "No, I wouldn't rule it out." I know there's no constitutional provision for a do-over, but let's start with an historical context, at least, which you have done, of course, in your book, Down for the Count. And as I mentioned, at least two American presidents won their elections, both in the Electoral College and in the popular vote, but yet did not become presidents.
Well, let me correct that a little bit. The Electoral College is what determines who becomes president, and in both cases, the Electoral College came down in favor of the winner. However, whether they would have done under other circumstances is the question at hand. In 1876, a tremendously contentious election in the wake of the Civil War, by any fair measure, both at the time and looking back historically, Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, won fair and square over Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican. However, three southern states were in the hands of carpetbagger Republican governments, and they refused to declare that Tilden had won their states. And there was a long crisis at the end of which the Grand Compromise was struck, whereby Reconstruction ended, which is effectively the occupation of the South by Northern troops. And Hayes, even though he hadn't won the election, became president. That was precedent number one, which was shocking enough to anybody who cares about the concept of universal suffrage, which in 1876 was not only well established in the United States, but was becoming the norm across the rest of Europe and the rest of the developed world. The other example, which got much less publicity, was the 2000 election, which, of course, featured that tremendous 36-day battle in Florida at the end. The Supreme Court decided that the votes should not be fully counted. George Bush won by default in Florida and therefore won the Electoral College and the presidency. What we found out close to a year later, when two media consortia got a hold of all the physical ballots in Florida and counted them all using varying standards, is two very interesting findings, one of which was highlighted by the main national newspapers, which is that had the recounts requested by the Gore camp gone ahead, Gore probably would have lost anyway, except under the laxest of standards. But the much more clamorous finding, which was highlighted in one or two Florida papers, but not in the New York Times or the Washington Post, is that had there been a full manual recount of the whole state, which neither party requested, but which would have incontrovertibly been the democratically correct thing to do, Al Gore, by any standards, would have prevailed. So we had actual physical proof that had the election gone ahead as, you know, most people understand elections should go ahead by counting the votes, we ended up with the wrong person winning, which is something that at the time was quietly glossed over. Bush was in the White House. There was nothing to be gained from it. Al Gore didn't say a peep, and the world moved on. What we're seeing now is a very interesting hypothetical situation, which is, let's say, and we do not know that this will come about, some kind of evidence comes along to question whether Trump really won in those agonizingly close states in the Midwest, and therefore whether he really deserved to get those Electoral College votes that made him president. What will Hillary Clinton do about it? Now, the precedent in the past is not to rock the boat. You know, this is not a country where elections are gentlemanly pursuits. They're vicious, nasty, drag-out fights. And, you know, the understanding with both parties has always been, if you end up losing, you know, after a contest, after whatever you choose to do in the immediate aftermath of the election, then the appropriate response is not to keep fighting, but to lick your wounds, go away, raise more money, and fight harder and dirtier next time and hope you win then. Which is what Richard Nixon, by the way, did. He felt he was cheated in 1960. There were a number of people clamoring for him to contest the election, you know, for weeks, months on end. And he told a journalist friend of his, you know, those are very interesting stories you're writing, but nobody steals the presidency of the United States. So he made a conscious decision. I'm not going to make myself political poison by pushing this any further. And of course, he had ambitions to try again. In Hillary Clinton's case, she's probably made the determination that she's not going to run again. Some people would dispute that. I think the publication of the book is evidence of that. She's a very cautious person. She's rather less cautious in this book than she's been in the past on the campaign trail, which suggests to me at least that she's not ambitious for high office anymore. And she feels like she's out for justice. And we don't know how this is going to play out. First of all, we don't know if the evidence is going to appear. But even if it does, and even if she starts trying to cry foul, we don't know what impact this would have. She says herself in the Terry Gross interview that there's very little, if any, constitutional grounds for a do-over. But it would create an interesting question, on the one hand, over Trump's legitimacy, and also, on the other hand, whether it's really smart to relitigate the 2016 election when the world has moved on. And maybe the smart thing for the Democrats and anybody who opposes Trump and wants to see him out of office as quickly as possible, whether Hillary Clinton is really your ideal champion. These are things that we will have to wait and see how they play out.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed, and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book just out is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. Well, still, you know, the fact that somebody won an election by 3 million votes and didn't become president. No other country in the world has such a screwy system as the Electoral College. And one would think that after the examples that we've just talked about and others, Andrew, that it would be time to jettison the whole thing. Of course, it's not going to happen, but it could happen. There's a way to do it at a state level. But without having to go through a constitutional amendment. But I'm not sure that that's on the cards. But the one thing that's so different about this situation today is that the involvement of a hostile foreign power. I mean, that's never happened before. It's been dirty pool, Democrats versus Republicans, and pulling out all kinds of mischief, pulling off all kinds of mischief. But nobody's ever had this situation before where a hostile foreign power has apparently meddled, and the extent of it is not entirely clear, but it seems to be very multifaceted. I've heard reports that the Kremlin dedicated something like $5 billion to this massive intelligence operation. So it's at the end of the day, it could yield something.
Right. Well, I mean, it's worth pointing out that, you know, as far as we know, it's never happened before in the United States. But of course, it's happened in other countries, and it's been, in many cases, the United States doing the manipulation from afar. And it's probably instructive to look at what those countries have done in response. You know, one instance that I'm very familiar with is Italy, where I lived for a long time. The Americans, you know, clearly manipulated the results of the first big election after the Second World War, which was the one that the Communist Party looked most likely to win in 1948. They were literally stuffing suitcases full of cash and handing them to party leaders, spreading disinformation, turning a blind eye to the mafia being recruited to intimidate people in Sicily so that they wouldn't vote for the Communist Party, and on and on. And what this created was, you know, a stunted democracy, I think it's fair to say, in Italy, in which there was an abiding resentment of the United States and in which there was rampant corruption, including corruption that involved the intelligence services and, you know, links to the CIA and other parts of the American establishment that were encouraging acts of violence, whatever it took to keep the communists out of power. The years of lead in the 70s and the early 80s in Italy were, you know, without any doubt, inspired, if not also directly funded and encouraged to some degree by shadier parts of the U.S. establishment. And, you know, Italy is, you can argue, is still suffering from the results, that there has never, you know, there are ways in which their democracy has not been as deeply rooted, you know, even 70 years after the fall of fascism, than it might otherwise have been. And I think, you know, that we need to think carefully about the consequences of ignoring this. On the other hand, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that the United States has its own longstanding historical problems in terms of having, you know, a dispassionate electoral system that is run in a nonpartisan, professional way. This is something that has eluded this country. Most other advanced countries have figured out a way to do it, at least, you know, mostly correctly. The United States has been, you know, plagued by problems of one kind or another. And of course, part of the reason for that is the long legacy of segregation in the South, the fact that, you know, African Americans were not accorded the proper right to vote for far too long. And even now, there is no formal enshrined right to vote in the Constitution. And it's something that hangs over the country and makes dirty elections of the kind that we saw in 2016 and many times in the past, you know, an imminent possibility. And I think it's worth ramming home the point that while Hillary Clinton is justly concerned and others are justly concerned about Russian interference, justly concerned about the interference of James Comey, as the FBI director, putting his thumb on the scale just a few days before the election, and all the other things that she's been talking about, you know, it was not a one-way street. That electioneering is a dirty business, as I said before, and it does run both ways. And sometimes one side will be more effective in their dirty campaigning than the other. Sometimes, you know, the dirty campaigning won't work because the candidate on the other side is too strong. So it's a complex situation. And, you know, while I think it's absolutely essential to get to the bottom of what the Russians did or did not do, it's a foreign policy issue, it's a national security issue, as well as an issue of democratic integrity. I think it's also important to look at the electoral system as a whole and the nature of politics in this country. And sadly, you know, it is not a question of waiting for the grown-ups to come along and say, let's do this properly because we have rules. We don't have rules. And so what we have is a political determination of where we go from here. And we have a very poisoned political environment right now with Trump and Kris Kobach trying to poison public opinion in the sense that they want them to think that voter fraud is rampant of a kind that doesn't actually exist, and that, you know, take the emphasis off money in politics, off dirty electioneering through social media, through all these channels that we saw in 2016. In other words, you know, there's a battle over the politics of elections, which is over the heads of most voters. And that is a very dangerous situation. And I think Hillary Clinton needs to think long and hard whether she wants to engage in that fight or whether, in fact, the smarter way to go is to hold her fire for the Democrats to figure out a political strategy to get rid of Trump and his ilk and that strain of Republican extremist politics as fast as possible and work on reforming the system, you know, once they get to that spot. You know, it's a political calculation as well as a calculation of the health of the democracy that we live in.
Well, indeed. But meanwhile, Trump, through his appointments, is doing enormous damage to the country in the eyes of Democrats. And in particular, what you've just mentioned, the Kovacs Commission, which the vice president co-chairs with Kovacs, is full of these zealots who... voter suppression zealots is the only other way to describe them. And that, it would be appalling if they were able to... I mean, essentially, they were created because Trump made these outrageous charges because he couldn't accept the fact that he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. So he came up with this idea that 3 million undocumented Mexicans voted. And these this commission is out trying to create laws to justify that massive lie. It's a horrible situation.
Right. You know? I mean, I would agree that what they're doing is contemptible in every conceivable way. I would also point out that I think politically it has had a number of setbacks. You know, we saw in the summer when Kovacs sent out a letter to the states asking for a vast amount of individual data on voters, you know, things that he should never have been asking for, including their party affiliation, which, of course, has nothing to do with the integrity of the vote. Other things, including, you know, status, addresses, personal details of military families, which is something the Pentagon has worked very hard for decades to keep out of the public domain for security reasons of those families and the military as a whole, and on and on. You know, this got a terrible backlash from Republicans as well as Democrats. There's a great deal of skepticism about Kovacs and his commission. And then again, just a week ago, when they held their first proper public meeting, the second official meeting, but the first one that the public was allowed to participate in New Hampshire, and Kovacs came out on the eve of the meeting saying that New Hampshire had been, quote unquote, stolen, that Trump should have won there, and Maggie Hassan should never have won the Senate seat from Kelly Ayotte. The entire congressional delegation in New Hampshire rose up and said, this is outrageous. The Secretary of State, who sits on Kovacs Commission, was at first reluctant to say anything, and then he came out publicly and said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the process by which we conducted our elections. So we're seeing a lot of pushback. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you look individually at what Trump is doing, and of course, you know, it's, you know, nobody on the other side of the political fence, and quite a few people on the Republican side of the fence, are not happy about the fact that Trump is in the White House. I'm not trying to minimize that. But we're seeing ways in which politically he is getting defeated in significant issues. You know, there's a question whether you raise the issue of his legitimacy in terms of the vote count as a political issue, whether that's a winnable issue or whether it is smarter and more efficient to hold your fire and wait for the next election and beat the Republicans and beat Trump, you know, next time around. I'm not advocating for one or the other. I'm merely saying that the history of this country shows that elections are an eminently political battlefield. They're not one where, you know, the rights and wrongs of how elections should be conducted is ever an argument that gets very far, unfortunately. But that's just the reality.
Well, clearly, Hillary Clinton's in a difficult position because, you know, she is, the more she talks about the Russians and Comey and other factors which contributed to her loss, we don't know the extent to which the Russians contributed to her loss. She's accused of shifting responsibility away from herself and the campaign that she ran. But just let's just assume, though, that Mueller, who has a lot of integrity and a lot of respect, comes out with a really definitive proof that the Russians, through their $5 billion active measures campaign, which was multifaceted, and now we're starting to learn all kinds of stuff about they actually had agents on the ground in these various swing states. Maybe just to speculate in closing that if it came from Mueller's lips, that it almost came out of Comey's testimony, frankly, if it comes from Mueller's lips that this last election was stolen by the Russians, what do we do then?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, constitutionally, I think, you know, most constitutional scholars will tell you there is nothing you can do. You know, the Congress has the option of impeaching the president, but it does not have the option of ordering up a new election. And, you know, the United States is very different in that respect from parliamentary democracies around the world. You know, in Britain in 1990, I remember when Margaret Thatcher, you know, from one day to the next, was pushed off her perch as prime minister by her own party members. I remember Americans I knew was, you know, shaking their heads in wonder and saying, how is this possible? And the answer is, you know, in a parliamentary system, you have that option. In a presidential system, especially one where the rules say, you know, the elections happen every 4 years and there's an electoral college and they decide who the president's going to be. And the only way to get rid of him or her is, you know, either by impeachment or through the mechanisms laid out in the 25th Amendment. Those are the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of stuck with them. And I think, you know, probably, you know, I think we've all got broken crystal balls at this point, but probably if something like that came along, you know, there would be a number of political decisions to be made. Number one, about impeachment. Number two, about a response to the Russians. Number three, about possible reform of the electoral system and or, you know, cybersecurity issues to prevent this or to do everything you could to prevent this happening again. You know, I think this would, I think it's probably not an exaggeration to say that one way or the other, it would be a significant psychological shock and check on the notion of American power, because there would be only so much you could do about it.
Well, Andrew Gumbel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gumbel, who has worked as an award-winning investigative reporter, a political columnist, and a foreign correspondent for The Guardian, The Independent, The Los Angeles Times, The Nation, and The Atlantic. He's the author of several books, including Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. And his latest book is Down for the Count, Dirty Elections and the Rotten History of Democracy in America. We're going to take a brief station break and back, assessing the chances of the efforts underway to repeal Obamacare with the Cassidy-Graham bill that is being pushed through the Senate ahead of a September 30th deadline.